This is the first session, and I'll briefly introduce this, the session. It's session one, Policy and Economics of Electrical Energy Storage. My name's Tony Vassallo from the University of Sydney in Australia, and I'll be chairing this first session. There are three presenters this morning. The first presenter is Anthony Price, and Anthony's going to talk to us about Don't Forget That, Past, Present and Future Philosophy for Energy Storage. And Anthony's bio is at the back of his paper in the Handbook of Abstracts. So please welcome Anthony Price.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Thank you to Imre for masterminding this conference and to the staff of DOE and Sandia for making arrangements possible and for putting up with people like me that turn up with their presentations late. And indeed, I've just changed my presentation, bearing in mind some of the comments which have been made already this morning. And the reason for doing that is partially so that we don't repeat ourselves too much, but also just to try and make sure that we're on the right track and we're going forward. My company's based in the UK, and in Britain at the moment we've got a number of really major issues that are arising. In government policy towards energy, especially the electricity sector, because it's an easy sector for them to so-called understand, is geared very much towards looking at three goals. One is security of supply. That means, have we got enough electricity available in order to keep all the lights on? One is to make sure that we've got low-carbon sources of fuel to keep the green side of the country happy. That equates to either low-carbon or sustainability. And the third thing is to do everything as economically as possible, because we haven't got any money. Now, what I did was to press the button on here. To make it go forward, If I press the button, does it go change forward? Should. I usually have a joke for things like this. It's usually for batteries and these things that go wrong. There it is. But I have to be careful about the jokes this morning, as this talk is being recorded. Although it's unusual, actually, that anyone does listen to it. I did give a talk a few years back when I was on the very last session of the last day of the conference, and they were selling tape recordings for $300 a go. And I left a message on it that said, if anyone is still listening to this, they send me the business card, I'll send them a bottle of champagne. And that bottle of champagne's still gone unclaimed. So this is a slide I brought forward in my presentation, which is based upon a thesis by Professor David McKay, who suggests that we want 20 gigawatts and 1,200 gigawatt hours of storage in Great Britain by the year 2030. The big question is where, when and how. And just to give a little bit more perspective on this, we also have a debate in Britain at the moment about transport links between London and Manchester, two cities about 200 miles apart. Now, there is no dispute that there is insufficient transport capacity, whether it's by rail, by air, or by road between these two cities. But the debate has become one about, should we just build a high-speed rail link between these two cities, or should we have alternatives? So the long-term goal is we need more transport capacity. The correct question is, what methods have we got to solve that? Not, should we just go for one particular option? And in looking perhaps at this 20 gigawatts and 1,200 gigawatt hours of storage that we need, the answer is not going to be in one single lump, and it's going to be a whole different variety. And I think what we're going to expect is to see that each manufacturer, each developer, will have their own product, which will have their own sweet spots. And those sweet spots, those strengths, will be brought out in diversity. So let's try and explore this a little bit further, because time is pressing on. Give me a clue, which button did you press?
That one.
Yeah, press it hard. There we go. All right. So, in theory, what I was going to talk to you about was to have some philosophical ramblings about where we've been and where we're going in the future. And this is Mr. Edison in his electric car, which is where we've been and is probably where we're headed in the future. But no talk like this would be complete unless we had a quick review of the electricity industry. So this is my highlights of the electricity storage industry. And you can see really that a lot of our earlier success was based upon direct current systems. As soon as we started switching away from DC, energy storage became a little bit more complicated, and we then were directed typically down the route of pumped hydro. We then went through this deregulated phase, and storage slowed down completely. And it's really only been in the last 2 years that we have seen this phenomenal growth and phenomenal interest that has put storage at the top of the green and clean agenda, which is really good news. But why is this so? So one of the first points that I'd like to make, really, is that we can look at a whole multitude of storage reports. And it's quite interesting that in the back of the proceedings book, there is a little catalogue of all the reports published by Sandia. And believe you me, that's only a small fraction of the number of reports that you can read on storage. What's really interesting is some of these reports describe 5 applications of storage, or 17, or 23, and they keep on making it more and more complicated. In trying to explain what storage does, I think it's quite helpful to remember that actually the electron doesn't know where it's come from or where it's going to. And the fact that we've got renewable energy on the system, or we haven't, doesn't actually make a lot of difference to what the storage application is. So in its simplest terms, we can think of storage just being a warehouse. It seems to work. It seems to go backwards and forwards. Anyway, so a few years back, a number of us were involved in a series of EPRI workshops on electricity storage, and we did postulate a number of laws of storage, and these have all been written up and put on the record. And it's quite interesting as we go through storage conferences how these keep emerging in different forms. And however we think of storage, and we think of a warehouse, we need to put it into context of what is the warehouse doing. And we want to approach this, I think, in terms of what is happening to the whole system. And as engineers, we have this tendency to try and draw a black box around the system and use that as the basis of our analysis. And I think that probably holds a very important key to the direction in which we want to take storage in the future. This seems to have a mind of its own, gentlemen, but we'll work with it. It's quite off-putting, really. What we're trying to do here is to take a daily demand curve, look at the demand curve, and then say, how can we analyse this to determine just how much storage we should want on a system? One of the effects of storage is that not only are you taking energy from one time of day and putting it back into another, but you're also affecting the source of our energy, whether it's done on a price or cost basis or whether it's just done on the basis of dispatch of fuel. So that we're altering the profile, not only of a generating plant, but the total system profile. There are savings for the system in terms of the total amount of fuel used. There are also improvements through diversity of supply. That's important when we're looking at aspects such as ensuring that we've got enough capacity on the system. The question is, can we ever find an optimum amount of storage to aim for? And that really depends upon what the storage is that you've got. And as we know, every single technology offered typically has a different ratio of megawatts to megawatt hours. The other variables are really affected by what else is on the system. Let's try this. And one of the variations there is that as we move from system to system, we see different degrees of penetration of renewable energy and baseload energy such as nuclear or coal or gas, and then highly flexible peaking plants such as gas turbines, diesel engines, or even conventional hydro. If we put that into a scheduler or an optimization program, we can come out with different solutions. And these are the sorts of things that have been done over the years and are still being done today. And back in Britain, we got people working on a 2030 and a 2050 system optimizer, and it allows us to look at what the conditions the system would operate in the years to come with ever-increasing amounts of renewables. And one thing is for certain, when they've run the system with the way it's expected to be configured in 2030, they've realised that they are critically short of flexible peaking plant. Okay. A few years back, we did some similar optimization, and it didn't matter really what the underlying generation mix was. However we arranged it, the net effect of putting storage on the system was to improve the overall system load factor, and if you translated that through, that led to a reduction in the total system operating cost. And in a logical, homogeneous market, that should reflect in lower prices to the end consumer. Which, of course, if you then remember the Cramer rule of storage, the person who owns the storage determines its value, or the corollary of that is that if the customer owns the storage, it indicates that the utility selling the electricity has probably got their pricing structure wrong. So we came out and we postulated a few targets. If you readjust the load curve, you come out with this very happy argument that there should be perhaps 30% storage on the system. That's clearly too much and is probably never going to happen in our lifetimes. But economically, we're looking at perhaps about 10 to 15%. EPRI, back in the 1990s, stated it should be 6%. But at the moment, we've just got 2.5%. And the situation is actually a little bit more dire because we've been building generating plant like it's been going out of fashion. You know, there's an extra gigawatt, or nearly an extra 1,000 gigawatts of plant gone on in the past 20 years, and storage simply hasn't kept up with that. So if you look at the purple line, you can see that the percentage of storage on the system has actually declined rather than increased. And it's unlikely, in our view, to increase for another 5 or 10 years. Furthermore, the load factors on our generating plant seem to have been dropping typically over the past 20 years rather than increasing. And this is likely to get worse as we bring more renewable plant on, which affects the running of our conventional generation. And you can see that illustrated graphically there. But as we move from system to system, we can see some interesting variations. And this is sort of analysis may be quite helpful to those of you interested in marketing storage products. But typically, we can see that in many countries, the penetration of storage has indeed carried on dropping. And it's only in a few places where it's been going up. An interesting idea I'd like to share with you is that if you went out and you just spent a dollar on a few different items, just what does it buy you? Well, it buys you 94 grams of cheese, perhaps half a cup of Starbucks coffee, a litre of petrol, 18 milligrams of gold, or 33 kilowatts hours of electricity. Interesting thought. Can we learn anything from it? If I was to ask you how much it would cost you to store that, just to buy the container to put it in, ranges from, say, you know, a fraction of a cent for the space in a cold store for cheese, through to the cost of a water tank or a petrol can. $20, I reckon, buys you an envelope in a bank safe deposit box, and the best part of $5,000 to buy enough batteries to put it in. So we do have a little problem in the way that we get over this. And really, it comes back to the whole idea of storage is the generation asset. And this is a graph which got me fired from a job because everyone thought they understood it, but they failed to spot the real significance here that storage is both used for moving energy and it's used in terms of providing flexible power. And it's those bits as we go up and down the curve where we can see some value. reminded of the fact that we haven't been making much progress in storage when I was filling in the questionnaire which was sent round to ESA members, you know, just how much storage are we likely to see? And it is low numbers at the moment. But we talked about that. We talked about those. What are we going to do in the future? Well, going forward, I think we've got to look at the whole system, and we've got to draw our black boxes around where the system boundaries are, and we've got to come up with value propositions which affect the whole system and work out a business plan which takes us from today, introduces storage for our niche applications, but allows us to walk down the storage value curve in a logical, methodical way, so that we do get up to the penetrations of storage of 10%, 15% of generation capacity, which we are going to need if storage is going to deliver real savings to everybody. So that's about it. I think there's a lot to be gained from doing modelling. Back in the UK, we are trying our hardest to get some sensible models which show the whole system benefit rather than just the benefit ascribed to a particular user of storage. And we do need to see good demonstration projects on the ground now and get the feedback from them to put that into the models. So that's probably it. Thank you very much.
Speaker number two this morning is Gabriel Miller. Gabriel's going to talk about the impacts of regulation, policy and advanced technologies and market dynamics on the deployment of energy storage processes.
Good morning. I thought it might be of interest to this community to see how the investment community views energy storage. I'm a person who is a professor at a university for over 40 years, and my background is engineering, but starting just a few years ago, I entered the private equity community as chief scientific officer with a company called Hudson Clean Energy Partners, which is a late-stage investor in the private equity sphere. So Hudson invests in later-stage companies that have passed demonstration and are ready for what we call prime time or full commercialization. So I thought it would be interesting for you to see how we view energy storage, and that's the paper that you see here. Incidentally, as a professor, speaking 15 minutes is a problem for me, and putting together a PowerPoint presentation in 15 minutes is even a bigger problem. So I'm going to have to run through a lot of these slides when I realize that was well over 15 minutes. But if anyone actually needs or wants or for whatever reason desires this presentation, if they come over to me afterwards, I can email the entire PowerPoint to them. So the first, I'd like to just introduce how we look at the field of energy storage. And to us, it's a confluence of factors which lead to what we feel are significant market opportunities. Now, you'll see as I go through this talk that there's almost no mention of particular companies or any differentiation with respect to how we view specific technologies. We look at them all, and we see where the fit is with respect to the market. So the confluence that we've seen here, which makes us somewhat bullish in energy storage, is the fact that we see significant future government policy and regulations coming to the forefront. There's opportunities in T&D deferral. Obviously, the increased renewables are important here. Smart grid integration into traditional systems, EVs, all of those factors seem to lead to what we call a confluence, which would make energy storage a more important value proposition. Now, how we view any technology that we look at with respect to investment is we try to look at the intersection of the technology with policy and markets. And what you'll see as I go forward is first we look at technology, we look at markets, we look at policy, which then leads us to certain conclusions. First, looking at technologies, the storage technologies, and I hardly need to elaborate all of these for you, batteries, flywheels, ultra-capacitors, thermal pumped hydro, and compressed air are things that most of you are very familiar with, starting with very traditional nickel-cadmium batteries used in UPS, or lead-acid, again, same sort of application, which have been around a very, very long time, to the new technologies, which include advanced lead-acid, obviously lithium-ion, sodium-sulfur that you'll hear more about later today, I'm sure, through the new flow batteries that people are looking at, including zinc bromide, as well as the vanadium redox flow batteries. Obviously, flywheels have made an impression, and this is a plant that was talked about before, a 20-megawatt beacon facility in New York State. Supercapacitors or ultracapacitors are ultimately, they may have very important EV power applications, and there may be an important application in utility-scale storage also. With respect to thermal energy storage, using ice has for distributed energy storage has been of some importance, and we look at that very carefully. With respect to pumped hydro, which obviously represents on the utility scale almost all of the storage in the world right now that exists on the utility scale is pumped hydro. There may be an interesting feature involving using seawater instead of directly using existing hydro facilities and pumping up and down. Now, I do want to spend a minute talking about the difference between power and energy batteries because this is something that that we've determined is an important factor in looking at storage batteries in general. There are power devices and there are energy devices in the field. And we delineate here what a power device is. I'm sure most of you or all of you know exactly what that is, as well as an energy device. But what I underline in the middle of this slide, I think, is the important part, which is that the effects of either applying the wrong device to an application, which is using an energy device in a power application or vice versa, or attempting to use one device for both power and energy applications can dramatically shorten performance life. And this may be a somewhat of a controversial factor and a topic, and I'm sure people will question this point later, and maybe I'm wrong. But from what I've seen to date, this idea of being what's called stacking applications, being able to use a given device from more than one application can be fine if they are all power applications or if they're all energy applications. And indeed, given batteries can be used as either power batteries or energy batteries. But when they're doing a power battery application, the design is somewhat different than what the same device could be, a lithium-ion, for example. You can have a lithium-ion battery doing a power application, and if you wanted to use lithium-ion for an energy application, there would be a slightly and sometimes substantially different system internal design. And using one type of battery for both applications can lead to some significant problems. So for those who are talking about stacking applications, and I've read all the reports related to that, I think we have to do that and be very careful when we're doing that. Now, after looking at technologies, we begin to look at policies, and I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that the regulatory atmosphere here in the United States is finally beginning to lead to a situation where storage will be more and more important. And there are federal, regional, initiatives that I've delineated there, and I'll talk a little about foreign regulatory initiatives in a moment also. With respect to the federal level, there is one existing order related to transmission planning which can have significant effects associated with storage, especially around renewables. And there are these what's called NOPRs and NOIs that FERC has issued related to storage, including one called First Fast, which can have very significant applications. The problem, and I'll talk about it a little bit more, is that these NOIs and NOPRs have a 18 months to 2 year time frame before they're even become final orders, and then the local ISOs and transmission providers have to somehow integrate into the system. So there will be a time lag before some very, very important initiatives will become law. And I list here what some of the independent power producers have out there. The most significant state in the regulatory regime, which has been very positive for storage, is the state that we're in right now, California, including what the CAISO is doing. I list ERCOT, the Texas system, has some important initiatives, as well as some of the Northeast and PJM and New York ISO and ISO and New England, as well as MISO. And so we do have regulations in place and going to be in place. There are some important problems associated with them, and that's listed at the bottom, is that there are either no performance-based payments or very low prices for ancillary services that are mentioned in there. Thank you. I list here some of the California programs. I'm sure you're all aware of AB 2514 and SB 412, as well as the renewable performance standards, et cetera. So the state of California has taken the lead, and you heard this morning about what San Diego is doing, and the same is true in the central and northern parts of the state. So. And that's all based on some of these programs that the state has already enacted. Aside from California, there are other states that are looking at doing programs, including Hawaii, which really needs a program, as well as New York and Colorado. With respect to internationally, in Europe, Germany seems to have taken the lead. So they have the most, they're not necessarily the most renewables. They will have the most renewables as we go forward, as they still have their feed-in tariffs for renewables. And there has been a whole program associated with getting storage involved. Interesting enough, China, in its most recent 12th five-year plan, has for the first time mentioned energy storage. The major thrust is related to EVs, but the Chinese state grid has already begun some utility-scale demonstration programs involving storage. So we believe that China will be in the future where a lot of storage will occur. With respect to markets, and I know I'm running out of time, this is maybe the most important thing I need to talk about, and I begin to make it larger and larger and larger, and that's what's going on with respect to gas here in the United States. The major competitor to storage, okay, is the utilization of gas for all the applications that we list here as I go along. And so I'd rather spend a little time talking about that. In the United States right now, the available natural gas resource, because of all the shale gas that have been found, is about 2,176 trillion cubic feet. Okay. It's an enormous number. It represents, at today's utilization, over 100 years of gas. Okay. Even if you take the gas, retire all the coal-fired power plants, and use just the portion of gas that's used for electricity, which is about 30%, okay, taking all of that gas, using the gas that's used for electricity now, together with the gas used for all the coal-fired plants in the United States, so all the fossil energy electric coming from our natural gas, we have 30 years of gas at least. Okay? So, and gas, as you know, is inexpensive. Gas right now is less than $4 a million BTUs. Okay? Even at $4.50, the levelized cost of energy is about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. Okay. It's very, very difficult for any storage system to compete simply based on cost. That's why regulation is so much a part of what needs to be done with respect to storage. Because as long as people can use natural gas for those peakers, okay, or build combined cycle power plants, which have heat rates under 7,000, in other words, 50% or so electrical efficiency, and cost less than $1,000 kilowatt installed, we have a lot of problems with respect to storage unless those regulations are put into place. And I list here the myriad numbers of, some people say 10, 15, 20. I think I have about 17 listed here, okay? And I don't want to go through them all because I have about 30 seconds left. So, again, if anyone needs these slides, I'll give them to you. Here's where we are, okay? We have systems that can do power very well. We have systems that do energy very well. We have regulations coming to bear which will have important applications to allow energy storage to prosper in the future, okay? But we have to be careful about when and how we deploy our energy storage systems. Please be careful about using power systems for energy or energy for power. Okay. So in conclusion, and I got about 10 seconds left, there are some value propositions now which can compare cost effectively with existing systems, especially gas, but most require new regulations to be enacted. Unfortunately, the process for passage can take years. Okay. Now, under some circumstances, ancillary service provided by power devices can be cost competitive, but inexpensive natural gas will continue to make storage solutions challenging. And unless regulations which put storage in the forefront, like First Fast, are enacted, we will still be challenged to make storage more and more available. Okay. But my final conclusion is assuming what is expected to occur on the regulatory framework in the next few years, if it occurs within that time frame, we believe the storage industry can expect exceptional growth both in the U.S. and internationally. Thank you.
In the policy and economics session is from James Iyer, and James will be talking on evaluating modular distributed electricity resources for utility transmission and distribution upgrade, deferral and life extension.
Good. So we're going to get a little more focused. We've seen some, heard some high-level presentations kind of covering the waterfront, and I wanted to drill down into this particular application. We heard a lot about that this morning from San Diego Gas and Electric, and I do think it's an important anchor benefit for some of the value propositions that we, some of us think are important going forward. So I'm just going to quickly define what this thing is, give an example, show the generalized framework that I've come up with to help you estimate the benefit. Talk just briefly about transportability and the importance of that, some key indicators of the good opportunity so that we have some sense of where these opportunities are, just touch on briefly the spectrum of compatible benefits and attractive value propositions that are compatible with the T&D deferral, and then just a few observations. So what is this? Well, what we're trying to do is delay the need to make an expensive T&D upgrade involving transformers, wires, and other equipment, and in some cases, land. The basis of the benefit is the avoided annual capital charge or the cost that you incur to own that piece of new equipment, also known in the utility realm as the revenue requirement, how much money the utility needs to take in to cover the annual capital charge for that plant. And a deferral, what you're trying to do is serve the load that exceeds the capacity of the equipment. You want to make sure that you're never loading up the equipment any further than it's rated. And then on life extension, what you actually want to do is reduce the load to below the rated the rating of the equipment, because what you want to do is reduce the thermal loading, and in a case of underground circuits, you want to avoid those ground faults. One important point, we've alluded to this several times, but investor-owned utilities need investments. They can't make money on an investment they don't need. They don't make. So investor-owned utilities make their money by investing in equipment. And this is evolving, but it's an important point to remember when people are wondering why we're not doing it if it's so great. As a side note, cooperatives are owned by the members, and municipal utilities owned by the cities. They have a little bit different incentive structure. They want to keep the price as low as possible. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at a load profile on a peak day. And here we've got the T&D capacity at 12 MVA or 12 megawatts if you have a high power factor. And you can see as the load's growing through the three-year period, it starts below the line, and then for 2 years it's going above the line. So we're going to assume a 2% peak load growth, and we want to focus in right here on the peak part, and we'll see that on the next chart. So here we are. Notice that the chart starts at 11 MVA or 11 megawatts, and we have those 3 years of load growth, and there's the T&D capacity at 12 MVA. So you can see in the second year we're actually exceeding the rating of the equipment. And the first year we've got a small overload of 77 kilowatts, less than 1%. And then in the second year, we're up to 318 kilowatts. Notice how quickly that's growing. So you have about a 2.7% overload in the second year. Over on the energy side, you can see that that's growing as well. The area under the curve gets bigger and bigger. So in the second year, we're up to close to 800 kilowatt hours of what I'm calling excess or unserved energy in this particular example. So what we're going to do then is take this example to the cost side. We've got an overload in the second year of 318 kilowatts, and we need 757 kilowatt hours to serve that load. So what I'm going to do is take a look at an example where we do 4% of the capacity of the T&D equipment, or about 480 kilowatts, because you're probably not going to try to hit that number exactly right on because there's uncertainty on the load growth. And then on the energy side, I'm essentially doubling the amount of energy that you would see from the chart, from the curves, to just about 1,700 kilowatt hours. So here's the generalized framework, and this is featured in one of the Sandia reports that was mentioned before. And here's how it works. What we're going to do is pick a T&D upgrade cost of about $125 per kilowatt installed. That's fairly high, but it's not uncommon. It's well within the area of typical. And what we're going to do, there's that 4% number. So we're going to add storage equal to 4% of the T&D capacity. And when we follow the plot, the ISO plot there for 4% storage, we end up with about $460 per kilowatt for 1 year. So you install that that plant, I think I said it was 480 kilowatts, you get $460 per kilowatt for 1 year, because what you're doing is every year you're going to reexamine this and see whether it makes sense. So what we're going to do, though, is pretend like we're deferring for 2 years. So if I put in that 480 kilowatt machine with almost 1,700 kilowatt hours for 2 years, we end up with $920 per kilowatt, and that's for a 2-year deferral. One of the things to keep in mind is, though, eventually it becomes impractical to keep adding energy and power to your storage system. And the plot on the right side shows how the benefit diminishes as the load continues to grow to exceed the rating of the equipment. I said I'd touch on transportability. What I have here is a series of 1-year deferrals, and then the little red bars, equal to the ones that I showed before in the example. The little red bars, I'm assuming you use this thing for power quality or reliability. I gave it a token $50 kilowatt year credit. But at the end of 10 years, by doing this with five deferrals and five of these little power quality deployments, you can show nearly $2,000 per kilowatt. And, of course, that's just for the deferral. So where are these opportunities? Well, obviously, high T&D cost is one of the criteria that are important. Another criterion that's really helpful is whether you can stack other benefits or not. And I'm going to talk about those in a minute. There are quite a few that are pretty compatible with this application. Slow peak demand growth rate is really helpful. Modest projected overload. So if it's going to overload a lot, you're probably just going to upgrade your T&D equipment. You like peaky loads because that means you need less energy in your storage. And then we talked about flexibility earlier, not just on the operation side, but there's flexibility on the capital planning and build out also. So if there's any uncertainty about large load additions, if there's any chance there's going to be a construction delay, for example, there's permitting or materials that you can't get. And if you have other resource constraints, if you don't have enough staff, engineers, or equipment, it may be that a modular approach is a good way to help deal with that uncertainty. All right, so some of the compatible benefits, energy time shift is obvious. Supply capacity, if the local peak happens to coincide with the system peak. Dynamic operating benefits, Matt Lazarevich mentioned those. They're kind of hard to get at, but it really does. If you have a significant amount of storage, you can operate your electric supply fleet much more efficaciously with fewer startups, less ramping, less part load operation. And I think that's kind of a sleeper benefit for storage. That's something that Bob Shanker over at EPRI has done a lot of work on. Then on the ancillary services, we don't need to belabor those. Regulation, voltage support, I like that. If you can do that locally, it's a lot more effective, especially if it's near the inductive loads, particularly compressor motors that tend to really pull down the system voltage when you're having a system-wide problem. Renewables integration, we've heard about that. I don't want to belabor. One of my favorites, though, is the bulk central wind generation to distributed storage. So if you can use your T&D system during the evening, fill up these energy stores down where the load pockets are, you reduce I2R losses, congestion, capacity needs, and so on. So that one's got some real interesting possibilities. Transmission congestion relief, if these things are located downstream from congestion, which is becoming a problem, that's very attractive. And then, again, local reliability and power quality. If the device happens to be in the right place, you can certainly do some of that, and that's part of the rationale for the community energy storage. So in closing, what are we talking about here? We're talking hundreds of dollars per kilowatt per year, and the reason for that is because you can use a small amount of storage, just a few percent of the T&D capacity, to defer a large lump investment. Usually they increase the capacity by a factor of a third. So in this case, they would have gone from 12 MVA to 16 MVA. And in this case, you might be able to use 480 kilowatts to defer that big upgrade. T&D life extension is especially compelling for those underground cables. They're very expensive to replace, and they're aging. We have an aging fleet of those cables. And what you need to do is keep pull the current on those at a level below its rating so you keep the temperature low and avoid ground faults because that's what kills underground cables. And we have to belabor. The investor-owned utilities need an incentive to do the T&D deferral. Certainly the ratepayers are happy if this happens because their rates will go down. And just a digression, there are precedents for this. We had the same problem back in the energy efficiency days because when the utilities were paying people to not use their product, it didn't really seem all that reasonable. And so there was an accommodation made such that the utilities actually made rate of return on the investment in generation that they didn't make. So I think there's, for now at least, we may have to hope for some of these contrivances, but ultimately a market-based approach is the way to go. Numerous other compatible benefits I listed, I think the key ones. And I think that T&D deferral can be an attractive anchor benefit for numerous value propositions. We talked about a peaker, ancillary services, distributed resources integration, both on the generation and demand side. Storage can certainly be like a hub, if nothing else, to optimize those other alternatives. High penetration distributed PV. We heard about some of the power quality problems, particularly on the voltage side. Storage can help out a lot there. And electric service reliability and power quality. It may be one of the best or the lowest cost, most efficacious ways to deal with those problems. So thank you very much.
Because we're open for questions and comment now. If you have a question, please put your hand up, state your name, and wait for the microphone to come. Jacqueline. Yes, is there a microphone? Front.
Gabriel, you mentioned that gas is an inexpensive commodity and difficult to compete against shale. That it's difficult for storage to compete against something like shale. What about the environmental considerations? How do you overcome that?
Okay. Well, first of all, there's no question that there are environmental effects of using fossil fuels. As someone who invests in clean energy and does not invest in natural gas, I'm very cognizant of it. But right now in the United States, first of all, gas is certainly cleaner than coal, and it will be used to replace coal. And the fact is that it's an indigenous resource. We're in a regulatory atmosphere where greenhouse gases, certainly over the near term, will not be something in the United States where there'll be a carbon penalty. And with respect to a number of the pollutants, including hazardous air pollutants like mercury, there is none in natural gas. There's no sulfur in natural gas, so there isn't an SO2 problem. There is a NOx problem. So it is cleaner than coal, and it is, basically marketed it. But the United States is going to use its natural gas. There are problems associated with some of the technologies to bring the natural gas out, the fracking problems and environmental effects and the use of a lot of water. All those things are true. But at the same time, it's clear that natural gas is not only here to stay, but it's going to be used more than ever before.
Yeah, I'd like to make one brief comment. If you look at the spectrum of benefits that folks talk about, it's important to notice that most of them are capacity related. They're equipment related. What you're doing with storage is you're tending to offset the need for other equipment. And if, in an ideal world, you could deploy the storage near the loads and, at least in theory, offset the need for a combined cycle plant or even a peaker plus the transmission and distribution and even provide other benefits, I think that's really something to keep in mind. On the energy side, storage is really going to have a hard time competing. Even if we went to all gas, you'd still have 20% losses. So you're never going to be able to go head-to-head on a price per kilowatt hour. I shouldn't say it that way, but it's challenging in the bulk sense. So.
Thank you. Another question or comment? We've got one down there.
Hello. This question is for Jim. I noticed in the figure you showed that the benefits decline fairly quickly as you go to increasing fractions of storage with respect to the T&D rated capacity. And I'm just wondering what's driving that rate of change of the Y-intercept with respect to storage fraction, and is it driven by the capital cost of the storage system? And if you had, for example, a bulk storage system that had had smaller incremental capital cost of energy capacity, if that picture would change substantially.
Right. Well, what's driving the need is load growth, and I use 2% load growth. So that curve keeps going up further and further each year. And the proportion of storage, especially on the energy side, you need more and more storage as you get further up the curve. You need to serve a lot of energy. So at some point, and let's face it, T&D equipment's inexpensive, much less expensive than storage, order of magnitude at least, if not more. So at some point, it just becomes economically attractive to put in the T&D equipment. This is really kind of playing on the margin for the most part.
Question on the natural gas. The Natural Gas Association, Transmission Association, has done... Can you hear?
Yes. Yeah.
Has done a study and determined that the transmission capability for natural gas is not up to the requirements for all this generation, and that $15 to $30 billion of investment would be needed to upgrade it, or people would have to choose between heating their homes or getting electricity. So even though gas is probably going to be stabilized where it is in price, there are equal challenges there that need to get addressed.
Well, that happens to be true, but if you see in today's Wall Street Journal, and must be reported in other newspapers, it's the lead story today, that the two largest natural gas pipeline producers of natural gas pipeline equipment have merged. It's a multi-tens of billions of dollar deal, El Paso, and I can't remember the name of the other company. But that's because transmission now, they're linking the transmission from especially in the north and northeast to the south so that the gas can flow actually for the first time from the northeast to the south because of Marcellus, which is the huge deposit in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York. And with respect to that particular condition, natural gas was always being transmitted from the south and from places like Texas, Louisiana, up north to the northeast where so much of our gas is used. Now that Marcellus is available, you'll see transmission being less of a problem for the northeast, and that's why they're even thinking of having transmission lines going from north to south instead. Yes, there is a transmission problem associated, but it happens to be less severe than the transmission problem associated with getting renewables from, for example, northwest to the east. So electric power transmission may be even a bigger problem.
Gabriel. This question is for Gabriel, way over here. Mike Manner with HDR Engineering. You mentioned what China and Germany are doing as far as energy storage technologies. Can you comment on the type of storage technology they're selecting and why?
Okay. In China, they're looking. The state grid has demonstration projects for three projects. Two of them are lithium ion, and one of them is a flow battery technology. In Germany, I honestly don't remember which particular technologies they're using. I should mention something else with respect to how the investment community looks at all fields, but let me talk about storage. We invest in two types of situations. They could be value chain, or they could be a development project, which would be somewhat technology agnostic. Well, with respect to value chain, that would be an investment in an A123 or in an NGK or whatever company we would be interested in. On the other hand, being a technology agnostic and looking at development projects rather than looking at specific technologies and letting the technology developers or the companies themselves actually bid for having their equipment used may make a lot of sense now for the investment community, because by being technology agnostic, if you find a project and you know on a dollar per kilowatt or a dollar per kilowatt hour basis what number makes the project look good, then you could go out to the community, whatever company could bid on the project, and ask them to bid on that particular activity and remain technology agnostic. So you will see developers in this field, as the field expands, actually being technology agnostic and asking the technology providers to bid, very much the same way that wind energy or photovoltaic or solar energy developers are doing now.
Quick follow-up. So you're saying that the three projects you mentioned in China and Germany, they're battery projects, so flywheels aren't getting developed in China, or pump storage or compressed air?
Pump storage is, I mean, pump storage is the traditional storage technology that's used everywhere. It represents probably 99% of all the storage in the world is pumped storage. So I sort of keep that separate. You know, if they have the three gorges and they're able to use pumped storage there, they do that. I'm talking about non-pumped storage. With respect to flywheels, I think at this point, and maybe the guys from Beacon know better than I'm not sure where in the world other than the United States we see flywheels right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, just a further comment on the gas distribution. I live in an area where a gas pipeline recently exploded and killed a lot of people and destroyed a lot of homes, and it's presumably the tip of an iceberg. So even though some of these bulk gas distribution possibilities may be there, the systemic problem is probably incredibly large in the United States because so much of the infrastructure is incredibly old, and I can't think of an electrical disaster that's on that same scale.
Do we have another question for the presenters? No. No one wants to ask Anthony a question on his past, present, and future visions? Okay, well, in that case, we'll wrap this session up. Don't forget to check out the posters during the lunch break, and we'll see you back in here at 12:45. Thank the speakers, please.